I'll be acting as your facilitator again this afternoon. We decided to take a little bit different approach to the session this month with an opportunity to do some comparing of notes across the country on experiences folks have had with community paramedicine in their states. So we asked for state EMS directors, medical directors, and others from state EMS programs or others who've had experience with community paramedicine skirmishes or developments in their state to share those with us. Before we get into that, can I just ask who has something to share today?
Kevin, Clay O'Dell here from New Hampshire. I got about 45 seconds worth of stuff I can share with you.
That's great, Clay. Thank you. Who else? And don't all speak at once. I know we have some folks from Pennsylvania signed up at any rate.
This is Dr. Mike Rehart. I'm from Pennsylvania. But we're just beginning a community paramedicine program, so I'm here to hear what you guys have to say. I'm a regional director from South Central Pennsylvania.
Okay, thank you.
And Kevin, it's Joe Schmieder from Pennsylvania, and I'm with Dr. Rehart. I'm here to listen. I think Dan Swayze might be on from Pittsburgh, and I know that he has some experience. And is Dan on?
You there?
Yeah,
well, Dan has, of course, been featured on this program a couple of times very recently, as a matter of fact. So we certainly would like to have maybe a thumbnail sketch, Dan. I'll give you a shot at that. That would be worthwhile. Anybody else?
Kevin, this is Nora Jean in Arkansas. And I have, you know, just a little bit to add because we're just getting started down here. But we're part of the, hopefully part of the grant program. We've got some groups here that are participating.
Excellent. Okay. Anybody else want to share with us today their experiences with community paramedicine? Doesn't have to be anything fancy, just if you've had anything that's been interesting or that we might find interesting.
This is Mike Wilcox from Minnesota. OJ, is OJ going to be part of the program today or not? If not, I can talk a little bit about what's going on in Minnesota.
Are you on, OJ? I know he was. I talked to him a week or so ago about this. Not hearing, but that would be fine, Mike. That'd be great. Anybody else want to share? I'm going to do a little bit of. Is Jay Bradshaw on? It's a big state office holiday in Maine today. It's called Patriots Day, so I will do a little bit for Maine. Anybody else want to share?
My name is Kevin Mundell. I'm from New York City, and I've been trying to lead a little bit of effort. I started a task force here, and so I wouldn't mind at least letting people know about what we're doing.
Dynamite. I heard another voice.
Yeah, this is Julie from Nebraska. I could share a little bit about what we're doing, and again, like the other caller, we're waiting kind of on the grant announcements to see how we move forward, but we are still progressing here in Nebraska.
Super.
This is Tom Nearing from North Dakota. I can give you a quick update on what we've done in North Dakota with the help of that esteemed gentleman, Gary Wingrove.
Great. Okay. Well, if you haven't spoken up yet, that doesn't disinclude you late for later. I'll give you just a quick update on the situation in Maine. We've had a very active state-based community paramedicine development program for about the last 14 months or so. And our intent was to, we've actually got some rural health outreach funds and established a position of state community paramedicine coordinator in the EMS office, and that's been me for the last about a year. And our approach was to establish a statewide EMS Nuclear Medicine Task Force again about a year ago, early last spring, with the help of some friends like Gary Wingrove, Ann Robinson, and Mike Wilcox. That has been a very successful effort. We have a state task force of about 70 individuals because it's drawn such interest from everybody from third-party payers to the home health community, nursing, physician's assistants, et cetera, as well as the EMS and hospital communities. And our intent was to, by now, have pilot programs. We've developed a framework for people to submit proposals for pilot projects within their communities. We had over a dozen communities identify themselves as being interested in being a pilot program community. And we had developed a couple of different types of pilot projects which people could do, either a formal community paramedic project in which you'd actually use graduates of community paramedic programs to sort of be generalist community paramedics in their communities. We have another category, which is we call an expanded or extended EMS practice, which is intended to be to address more narrow applications of specific projects and not be sort of a generalist. We expect most of the initial projects are going to be in that latter category. Well, people are actually going to school to be community paramedics. We ran into one interesting problem, and that was one we did not anticipate. Our interpretation of what an EMS system could do was a very broad one that came out of the tradition of EMS system planning, which basically said that EMS includes prevention of those medical emergencies and injuries that the system ends up responding to. And therefore community paramedicine and prevention activities and some primary care activities would fall within the scope. The AG's office here did not offer any resistance on that for about the first 9 months of our program, and then suddenly as we were about to go out with pilots, they said, well, we don't think that that the board of EMS is authorized to do community paramedicine practice in a non-emergency mode. So we immediately went to the governor's office, and long story short, we're able to get legislation through now to enable us to run a dozen pilot projects. We have some limitation on it in that we're not allowed to blatantly duplicate any disciplines, practice, scopes of practice, but there's room enough in there for the development of community paramedicine. So that's where Maine has gotten. We are going to be moving ahead soon with pilot projects and looking forward to that, hoping to get some of that grant money as well. Let's move slightly to our west. Clay O'Dell, you want to talk about New Hampshire's experience?
Sure, Kevin. You hear me okay?
You bet.
Okay. So at the outset, I want to say that we unfortunately probably aren't going to be participating in any of the national grant stuff. Drag our heels maybe a little bit, but that's okay. Basically, what I wanted to do was to make sure that things came from a kind of a grassroots effort. You know, our experience in New Hampshire is if the state thinks it's a good thing, the folks that are somewhat suspicious of it. So we wanted to basically introduce them to the concept and kind of see where it went from there. So we invited one of my dear friends from the East, Kevin McGinnis, volunteered to come over and talk to us back in January. We had our EMS coordinating board meeting and our medical control board meeting, so Kevin spoke at lunch and graciously talked amongst people chomping and moving their sandwiches and stuff around, but did a really good job of introducing the concept to our folks. We had about 50 attendees, which was really good attendance. We did invite somebody. I thought at the last minute of inviting somebody from the New Hampshire Nurses Association, asking them, describing it to them and asking them to come over. They unfortunately weren't able to send anybody over, but one of our coordinating board members is an emergency nurse who's also on their board. So I think she'll be able to move that forward. She's also a paramedic, and she thinks it's a good idea. So basically, I gave folks a month to think about it and then sent out a message to the same group and said, so what do you think? Anybody interested? And we did have four services who came forward and said, yeah, we're really interested. Where do we go next? So what we're doing right now, in fact, on Thursday, I believe, we're going to have a small group get together to take a look at licensing issues to see if somewhere in the New Hampshire EMS laws we can find a loophole that will allow emergency responders to function in a non-pre-hospital environment. We think there might be some wiggle room, but we're not 100% sure. So we're going to look into that. We do have a legislator who's an EMT, who's a paramedic actually, who's going to be participating in that as well. And after that, we're going to put together a monthly task force to kind of share information, find information, and I keep sending the information about this call out to that group, and I expect a couple of them at least are probably on this call now. So the other thing about the New Hampshire Nurses Association, I think it's going to be important to stay in touch with them. In addition to having one of our folks on their board, I did send a copy of the American Journal of Nursing, I guess it was an editorial on community paramedicine, but I think that's a really important move. So that's all I got, Kevin.
That's super. Thank you, Clay. Let's move westward even further. Nora Jean from Arkansas.
Yeah, can you hear me?
You bet.
I will tell you that my first experience, other than what I had gandered online with community paramedicine, happened to be when I attended a joint committee meeting between NASEMSO, which is the National Association of EMS Officials, and NOSOR, the National Office of State Offices of Rural Health, in Denver last year, and was fortunate enough to meet both Ann and a representative from EagleMed, West Eagle County, Colorado, whose name escapes me right now, paramedic who's really one of the first that's really been, let's say, that the media has caught hold of in the community paramedicine process. And he explained to us what they had developed in Eagle County, Colorado, West Eagle County, Colorado, to meet the needs of very rural people who, for whatever reason, were at home and their doctor felt like they needed a visit to make sure they were doing okay post-hospital, to follow up on post-treatment of some sort, or just to check on Mrs. So-and-so because she has a need. He works under the auspices of the medical director, I believe, of their countywide ambulance service. And that countywide ambulance service looks like it's a third the size of the state of Arkansas, to tell you the honest truth. Maybe as big as some of you guys up in the Northeast. Big service, lots of area to cover, and they felt like it was important to have to use this kind of a process. They got a lot of their information, I think, from Gary Wingrove and Kevin McGinnis, kind of developed their program there, and Ann was with them had worked, I think, with that service originally and developed the curriculum for community paramedicine. It took me about 20 seconds to fall in love with community paramedicine and about 35 seconds to figure out that it was perfect for what we have in Arkansas, and they seem to have worked out a lot of the kinks. One of the things I find out that I know from having worked in rural service in Arkansas is that we have our frequent flyers that call on Saturday night because they're either lonesome, they're scared, they heard a dog bark out back and they thought the boogeyman was coming. And after a while, a lot of our small and large rural services, on your way back from dinner, you stop for a minute, go by and see Mrs. So-and-so's okay, because you know if you don't, at 10 o'clock she's going to call you with something. And that something's probably a no-haul, because she either thinks she just needs a little attention or for whatever. And sometimes it was just follow-up with our hospital patients who had been discharged, and we had maybe taken them home or knew of them because they'd been at our hospital-based service. and we just rode by the house and went, oh, hi, Mrs. Jones, how you doing? We came to make sure you're okay. They've taken this to the next level and are using it as a deterrent to frequent flyers and a service to the patients, because sometimes they don't know what they need, or they don't, that they think they need an ambulance, but maybe they don't, or maybe they need to be checked on and they don't call an ambulance because, well, let's face it, we've got some elderly people that think when you call the ambulance and go to the hospital, you're never coming home again. So Eagle County has picked up on this. They've been able to figure out how to get it through their state association, how to get their state to recognize it. And at that point, I think they were funding it through their ambulance service, but I think they're working on some other things so that they can get, you know, Medicare, Medicaid funds to cover what they are doing. It's what rural Arkansas is going to need in the future for a lot of us. We've been doing this stuff for free for a long time. I suspect a lot of other states have been doing the same thing or haven't been able to do it because they couldn't justify it based on the way the protocols or the pre-hospital items were written. I think it's our future. I'm just as excited as we have got one of our programs in the north. Well, we've got a group of ambulances, group of counties in our northeast section of the state, northwest, that six or seven counties that have gone together and created a regional ambulance authority. They all work under the same protocols. They use each other's medical directors, depending. They kind of rotate through. And one of our community colleges that are working on being part of the Medicare Medicaid grant program that's being done through the FLEX programs, they've put together, they've been chosen to be one of the 16 programs that are being used. And once all that comes through, we hope we're going to have the first class in Arkansas under the new number 3 curriculum that Ann's worked on so hard. We're excited, and we think we can work it within the confines of the way our rules and regs are written. We've had no negative feedback so far, and we've been talking it up a bunch. Keep your fingers crossed. That's pretty much all I've got to say.
Well, we will keep our fingers crossed for you, Norgie, and I think that sounds like great progress there from standing still to about 60 miles an hour in a short time. And who was that masked man from Western Eagle County, Colorado? Why, that's our own Chris Montero, who's manning the recorder for this show. Chris, you got anything you want to add based on Nora G's comment?
Other than Kevin did speak at that conference, and it was great, and just getting his perspective and kind of a boots-on-the-ground kind of guy that's looking at it, I think was great. We've been working really hard with Gary and the North Central EMS Institute on this curriculum, and I think Ann could give some insight as to where it stands for version 3 and where we can go with that. But that doesn't seem germane to today. Maybe we could just do that at the end. I really feel that this is a good move for our industry in that we can really elevate the education of paramedics, we can provide health care, and we can really create a community of a web of resources and really create a community support system that that many, many communities need, and really create a new paradigm in healthcare and just be a part of the solution. I'd never say that we're all of the solution.
Okay, Chris, thanks. Thanks an awful lot. Let's move to the north middle of the country and talk about Minnesota for a couple of minutes. Dr. Wilcox, would you like to tell us about the new legislation and what's going on there?
Yeah, thanks, Kevin. As you may be aware, the state of Minnesota did pass legislation a year ago to recognize the community paramedic as a provider who could be reimbursed through the medical assistance program here in the state. We then went ahead and developed a fee schedule for the services of this provider, and that was addressed then by the legislature this year. Very happy to say that this legislation passed unanimously through the House and the Senate, and I believe a week and a half ago was signed off on by Governor Dayton, so that now these providers can be reimbursed for their services, at least through the Medicaid system, with a fee schedule. So with that in place now, of course, we're working with Medicare. They're interested in developing some pilot projects in our state using this provider as well. And then, of course, other third-party payers within the state are going to be, you know, looking at this also for reimbursement purposes in the future, which is very exciting. We also have moved ahead. The state was nice enough to give us a grant through the Department of Employment and Economic Development, Minnesota Job Skills Partnership, gave us $250,000 grant to develop some ongoing educational opportunities for the community paramedics within our state. This was a grant that was developed in partnership with North Memorial Medical Center, Alina Health Systems, and Health East to develop over the next 3 years 30 CPs per year to be utilized within their service areas to address many of the very issues that have been brought up by, you know, our other participants here today. In particular, they will be utilized after they're trained to go to homes where individuals dealing with chronic diseases, in particular diabetes, heart trouble, chronic pulmonary disease, and so on, can be watched over in their homes, hopefully to keep them healthy at home and outside of the hospital. So over the next 3 years, we'll be providing this training through our MinSCU system here in the state to train these individuals to that level of care. Very excited about that. Again, this will be a type of provider that will be utilized in areas where there is a need. Our thinking is it could be certainly this provider could be used in a rural setting for sure. Minnesota has a healthy number of individuals in a rural setting, but also could be useful in a metro setting as well, where there are pockets of individuals who can't access health care or they tend to overuse our EMS systems for their health care and hopefully prevent them from needing to be transported into the hospital for further management. So all in all, we're very excited about what's going on here in our state. And, you know, of course, we're very interested in assisting other regions in this area of community paramedicine if, indeed, they would wish some input from us.
Thanks, Mike.
You're welcome.
Appreciate the comments, and I can certainly endorse the usage of Dr. Wilcox and Mr. Wingrove in areas that want to begin looking at community paramedic programs. As I said, they did come to Maine for our initial task force meeting and helped us a great deal in that regard. And now we're all out spreading the gospel, so to speak. Gary, did you have anything you wanted to add about from the Minnesota perspective?
No, I think Dr. Wilcox did great.
Okay. Well, in that case, let's continue moving west. I think I'm going to start becoming geographically challenged here, however. Tom Nearing?
Yes. We've started the efforts in North Dakota. We happen to be fortunate that we're geographically located between Minnesota and Montana. So I've been out to the large stakeholder meeting that Jim Dettine held out in Montana. Dr. Wilcox was there as well. And, of course, Gary Wingrove is in Minnesota, and so Gary has been helping us with some of our needs with regards to community paramedics. So we happen to be geographically located in an ideal spot because we can learn all of the things that they're doing and go from there. What we're doing for the future is, I don't know if everybody understands what our EMS system in the state of North Dakota looks like, but we have approximately 14 full-time ambulance services, and we have 120 that are volunteer ambulance services or some form of volunteer. So we're really looking at this similar to what Dr. Wilcox was talking about, somewhat of an urban model in the larger communities within North Dakota where we're going to be looking at, you know, overutilization of Medicaid for both ambulances and for hospitals. We'll be looking at Medicaid first because, obviously, being part of the state, we can have a big influence there. One of the problems that we face is that the legislature in the state of North Dakota only meets once every 2 years. And so they meet in the odd-numbered years, and they meet from January basically through the middle of April. So we have to have our efforts pretty well put into place by January of this coming year. Otherwise, we will be stalled for an additional two-year period of time. And, of course, I don't feel that we, you know, have a robust program at this point in time to even present to the legislature, but we've got good support here from the governor and good support from the health officer in the state of North Dakota with regards to the concept of community paramedics. And so we think that's going to be real helpful. What we have established so far is we have an EMS advisory council, 14 people that advise our office from the industry around the state of North Dakota that includes, you know, many different individuals representing many different walks of life. And we have a subcommittee of the EMS advisory council that is really the driving force behind the community paramedic model here in North Dakota. And so we're looking at perhaps maybe some different kinds of approaches. Obviously, there are places within North Dakota that have lost their hospitals, have lost their clinics, really have no health care provider, and the only providers still within those community are the EMS people. And so we feel that we would be filling that niche out in those areas, as well as what I talked about in the urban areas. Our health officer has been very excited about this. He's talking about getting into a number of things beyond perhaps what we even consider the usual community paramedic model. He's talking about such things as prevention, occupational health, prevention there obviously as well as you know, going out to businesses and selling the services. In North Dakota, we have mostly very small businesses that can't afford have one of the bigger health care systems in the state come out. And so we're also looking at occupational health. We're also, for those of you familiar with Ask a Nurse or a Call Nurse program within the state of North, or within your own state, we're looking at doing something like that. And the reason why is that because especially in those rural services, we have an awful lot of downtime. One of the things that we're moving to because of the volunteer based dwindling is we're looking at, you know, how you can have one full-time or two full-time positions within the ambulance service, and with that downtime, you need to have them involved in something else that may potentially also bring a revenue stream with it. So those are some other thoughts that our health officers had that we've discussed around here. We had Gary Wingrove come up to one of our subcommittee meetings, and I've worked with Gary in the past. He does an excellent job, and we'll continue to have him involved. Basically, where we're headed at this point in time is we're looking at this summer of having the large stakeholder meeting. I don't know exactly when. I'm going to ask Gary to come up as well, too. And even though Dr. Wilcox doesn't know this yet, we did talk a little bit in Montana. I'd like to see Dr. Wilcox come up. With regards to what we're looking at as far as a training entity, we already have some universities within North Dakota that really want to get involved in this program. We've got the Masters of Public Health program at the North Dakota State University. They really want to be involved in this. And I've recently basically gotten into a partnership with the UND, University of North Dakota, Medical School, and I think they have reasons that they want to be involved in the program as well, too. So we don't know what's going to happen to development, but what we need to have happen is we need to have our feet on the ground by January so that we can get legislation introduced within the state of North Dakota. So yeah, that gives you a bit of an update on what we're doing here in North Dakota.
That's great, Tom. Thank you so much. Do we have any questions for anybody that's presented so far? Okay.
I do have a question.
Sure, go ahead.
This is Mike Mooney from New Jersey. How are you doing?
Good. How are you, Mike?
Good, Kevin. Thanks for everything. I really appreciate the effort that everybody's made to provide us with all this information that we're benefiting from as we move into this feasibility study from our standpoint. But one of the questions I had, and anybody can answer this, is were there any stumbling blocks? Were there any particular organizations or groups of people who posed any kind of roadblock to putting a community paramedicine program into their state?
Well, I think there are going to be a couple of very quick answers on that one, and I'll answer for Maine at this point. It was interesting because as much as we expected from Minnesota's experience to have a big red flag from the nursing community, our Nurses Association in Maine is under the same umbrella as the one in Minnesota. We actually did not have that. One of the areas that we did run into some difficulty with was the Home Health Association. And fortunately, it's a small community here, and we all know one another fairly well. We've worked through those issues, and to a degree with some help, some perspective help from Dan Swayze and how he and his EMED program have worked with the home health entity within his health system, have actually been able to manage that fairly well here by agreeing that, by and large, we are not care managers. At least in Maine, our approach to community paramedicine is episodic, and we are not attempting to be care managers. That's the role for nursing, for PCPs, for others, and it is not within our scope of practice. That was a definite relief as far as they were concerned. The second issue was simply making sure that we skirted those types of care that home health was eligible to receive reimbursement for, and to put our services at the edges of their services so that we would pick up things that they couldn't. And again, that was a relief as far as they were concerned, and so our legislation was able to go through. Mike or Gary, you want to talk about the Nurses Association in Minnesota?
Gary or Mike, this is Buck here. I was able to get on the call, too.
Oh, welcome. Thanks.
Yeah. Our problem in Minnesota on the first year, last year, when we did enabling language, was initially the nurses just land blasted us. And we had about 14 different groups that initially opposed our language and came forward. I mean, you wouldn't believe the folks that come out of the woodwork. But just what the last gentleman just said, surprisingly, as we got it through the legislature last year and we worked over the interim, our legislature meets in a two-year cycle, first-year budget, second-year state bonding. We had a real good discussion with the nurses and home health and folks during the summer about exactly what we want to do with community paramedic and kind of what you just explained from, I believe, Maine. And this year the nurses came out, they met with a work group with us, the Department of Human Services, on the payment methodology. And the funny thing is that they partnered through us with the whole discussion, and then sure dickens, as we get the bill introduced, they come out with a big letter and oppose it. And home health was also our big hurdle, and the gentleman that lobbies for them actually bailed us out and worked hard with them to say, listen, there's holes all over the state that don't have any services at all, and maybe it's a community paramedic that gets with it and helps. But there's just such a drive to decrease the total cost of care for our Medicaid spend that the legislature just overwhelmingly supported it. And I would say anybody that's working on and like to pass enabling language and move this program forward, you need to spend a good year ahead of time identifying these groups, and we should probably develop a list of who they all are. We had nurse anesthetists, everybody under the sun that think we were going to do something in somebody's home or a different setting or a primary care clinic. And now they're all up to the table with us talking about how we integrate community paramedics into the system and have them work with folks. And believe it or not, we think the nursing associations became our partners in this more than adversaries as we moved it forward.
Anybody else have experiences of this sort they'd like to share?
Well, can I jump in with a question? This is Kevin Mundell from New York City. And I like that word, enabling language. Right now we're in Europe, we're trying to comb through all the various regulations and guidelines and try to see what exactly are the limits of under the existing regs and statutes. And I wanted to sort of get some more insight as to how functionally you went about that process and how you were able to, before you put a package together, go to the legislature, what were some of the steps along the way?
I think we're kind of unique in Minnesota. I'm not sure what everybody has, is our paramedics here are certified, so we work on a floor. Our industry for years has wanted to drive us to licensure, and we said once we get to licensure and we put a scope of practice in the state statute, it'll be very hard about what we do and what we offer as skill sets. So being certified helped us out quite a bit. Also, about 10 years ago, O.J. Doyle, who's our full-time lobbyist for our state association that works with me, we were getting challenged that under the scope of practice law, the nurses and folks would come forward and say that paramedics were not allowed to give IV drugs or administer medication like nurses do. So we exempted us from the Medical Practices Act as under 144E, where our EMS statute sits for ambulance paramedics. So I would remind people to look at your statutes and how you fall under your scope of practice and what you're allowed to do. Once we exempted us from that, we brought that up to the nurses this year about our payment methodology, and they said, oh, so there's 7 or 8 things in our state law that's exempted from the scope of practice over care because we work directly under, Dr. Wilcox is on the call as one of our medical directors for the company I work for, North Memorial, our ambulance license. So once we looked and established where we had some positive things we did in the past and being certified, really all we were doing is not expanding our scope of practice, but just offering another skill set under the medical director's license. So I think if you're a licensed state and you have a scope of practice, it's probably going to take you a little longer to enable community paramedic as a service you can offer.
This is in Nebraska. We are anticipating that here, and we are looking that we will probably try and put legislation through that will start the 407 review, which is scope of practice change. We're hoping we'll be able to do some pilots, but we anticipate that we will have a bit of lengthy work in getting the scope of practice accepted for community paramedics here in Nebraska.
Julie, since you're talking about Nebraska, is there anything else you'd like to describe about where you've been and where you're going?
We've been on the journey a little longer, and with the help of Gary and Dr. Wilcox also, we have put together the task force, met. We were able to pass legislation, LB 646, that removed the word immediate from the statute, which is going to allow some of the paramedics to do things that are not dispatched under 911 because they are under their medical director's license and they will be able to do those visits. However, reimbursement is still an issue. That is why we're hopeful that we will be funded either through the Innovation Grant along with Gary. We have Tom Townsend from Omaha that is one of the 16 sites. And RNRAN, the Rural Nebraska Regional Ambulance Network, also submitted a $5 million grant for the innovation for pilot in Scott's Bluff. And we then grant to 3 small communities for community paramedicine. So if we get things, this will be great. If we don't, we are going to go ahead and move through RNRAN towards the legislation and looking at how we can get all the pieces in place. We did run against a lot of resistance originally on the legislation we put through from the Nurses Association. Me being a nurse, I guess I was able to reach out, and we educated them. And I would say that's the biggest thing. Get the stakeholders to the table before you start pushing through the legislation so that they don't feel they're blindsided and they don't start their own message
that can be way off course. That was what we had to do, was just re-educate people to actually what the issues were and what we were trying to do. So I think if you do that up front, it is much more timely than trying to redo it afterwards. We're excited. We hope that we're going to go ahead and, like I said, start talking with the legislators to move forward with the community paramedicine legislation, which will probably force the 407 review, but go ahead and get those things in progress, because we really think in our frontier and rural areas, this is going to be just a necessity for care out there for our folks.
Super. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Kevin from New York City, was there anything else you wanted to add about your project?
Well, I just wanted to, first of all, thank the people on this call, and I've been on a couple of these now and definitely benefit from some of the insights. In New York City, we're sort of starting a little bit of a grassroots campaign, and I think what we're trying to do, we've set up this task force, but it's, you know, not sure when everyone else used the word task force, they may imply something that was designated by a governmental agency, whereas we're very much outside of government, and we're trying to position ourselves such that we become a coordinating body for some of the health systems and ultimately some of the trade associations, the hospital associations, and then ultimately with some of the government agencies. And I think that's sort of a challenge for us to how to exactly accomplish that amidst such a highly competitive environment here in New York City, where people don't really want to come together and share ideas, and how to in such a bureaucratic city with so many a very powerful city and state authorities. And so, you know, we're struggling with some of those issues. I think that we have the wind at our backs because of all the great work that you guys are doing in so many other states. And I think that's definitely helping us to make some of the case to different individuals. But we're still working on trying to get to a point where this task force is seen as a legitimate agent to change on this issue.
Who do you actually work for, Kevin?
I'm a hospital EMS medical director for Mount Sinai.
Great. Okay. Great perspective. Dan Swayze, are you still out there?
Yes, sir.
Well, you've heard some of the discussion that we've had today, and you certainly by far have the most experience in trying to implement community paramedicine-like programs there in Pittsburgh. Anything you'd like to offer?
My condolences and commiseration for all those who were fighting the regulatory battle early on in our process prior to Joe Schmieder's tenure as our state EMS director. We encountered a lot of those same hurdles, and I think it's to be expected, but that those issues are resolvable. And with following the advice that's been given earlier and really bringing home nursing and the nursing lobby in as a stakeholder early and let them know that you're trying to develop complementary programs to theirs and not ones that are going to compete for their limited funding, I think you'll have a lot of success, and there's still plenty of opportunity out there for us to do some pretty significant things. And from a scope of practice perspective, that's what I've heard is a lot of you are looking at your physician practice acts and whether or not they can delegate those responsibilities to your EMTs and paramedics in this role. And that, too, is exactly the model that we had to use early on in the process to get our paramedics to do immunizations. We worked under the Medical Practice Act and had our physician medical directors delegate their medical practice authority to us so that we can go out and do that, since it was at the time prohibited in our scope of practice in Pennsylvania. So just consider as you're trying to implement these programs that the EMS-enabling legislation is there for EMS providers in the traditional EMS role, and that you're more than likely going to have to find a workaround to that early in the process until you can get your scope changed to include some of these community and preventive efforts initially. So, and I'm certainly happy to talk to anybody about more specifics about our experiences if they want to have an offline discussion at any point.
I would also heartily endorse using Dan's or tapping into Dan's experience. He and I, we've co-presented along with Gary and others. I mean, we all seem to be doing the traveling roadshow thing on community paramedicine across the country here in various places. But Dan has experience with a number of different approaches to community paramedicine projects and services that he's tried. Some have worked, some haven't worked, but they're all good learning experiences. And my service at our health system here in Maine engaged Dan in a two-hour webinar where he did a presentation that I'd heard on the road, but it was very, very helpful for those people in our system who had not run into community paramedicine to get a real sampling for what some of those services can be like. So I highly recommend Dan in one form or another, either by remote control in a webinar setting or in person. He's a great guy. Are there any others? I don't know if I missed anybody on the list. Anybody else would like to contribute to the conversation today?
Steve from Florida. Yeah, I can put into what we got going on from a Department of Health standpoint and a regional piece.
Great. Please go ahead, Steve.
But basically, we have several different programs throughout the state that are kind of popping up, and a lot of them put in for the CMS Innovation Grant and things like that. And a lot of people are coming to us from a state's perspective, asking us for direction and things like that. So our leadership here at DOH, we completely lack the authority to regulate or create any type of certification around this. But our approach is that we do have the authority to coordinate. We've been doing that since probably about mid-February. I've consulted with Gary and Chris and everybody else and tried to rob, plagiarize, or get anything I can to come up with some type of minimum state requirement. And we've been pretty successful so far. As far as, the learning piece, we have a curriculum framework. Let me rephrase that, a draft curriculum framework. We have a draft data dictionary that is based off of the NMSIS 3.0 standards. We have beginning of some minimum statewide protocols that our state EMS medical director, Dr. Joe Nelson, is being a part of. So, and just basically some minimal guidelines that would be from a Department of Health and a state standpoint as a minimum recommendation, since we lack the complete authority. What we were doing is we were approaching, different people saying, hey, Nursing Association, we're talking about this community paramedic thing, and they were like, what is it? And we really had nothing to show them but, just saying, hey, this is good stuff, go to this website or talk to this person. But now we have basically some draft minimum requirements and things like that we can say, hey, here's what we're looking at. This is what we feel that it is. Tell me what you need. Like, we went to some mental health folks, and we did that with them, and they made some, included them in the beginning part of it, and they made some excellent recommendations for the framework. We got a lot of people that have put a lot of good effort in on the data, minimum data set that is NMSIS 3.0 elements that we're making mandatory for the state of Florida if you are submitting to if you have community paramedic programs. So all in all, we're moving on pretty quick, even with the lack of any type of authority. But we know it's a matter of time before we're approached from a department standpoint that legislature from out the state is going to say, come to our office and say, tell me about this, and we'll actually have that information to share with them at that time. But that's basically it in a nutshell.
Okay, Steve, thank you very much for sharing. Appreciate that. Anybody else want to share with us?
Actually, this is Dell Atkerson from Oklahoma. Not to share, but to ask a question, if I may.
Absolutely. Go ahead.
I am still just in the information gathering process of this. We do have a couple of agencies that applied for the HRSA grant, but I have not heard any any feedback from those agencies about that. But my question is this, and again, please forgive me if this sounds naive, perhaps might be the way to put it.
There are no stupid questions, Chris.
Okay. When I look at this community paramedicine model, I look at it as being that true bridge between absolutely nothing and something in these rural communities. But I'm wondering if the other states that are implementing this are looking at going into the geographic regions of their state that truly have no health care coverage, you know, no physician, no hospital, where the folks are truly having to drive 50, 60, 80, 100 miles to get to their locations. Is that the model that everybody, that the certainly the Western states seem to be looking at, or are we looking at possibly integrating this into a home health care setting or situation? And I appreciate the time.
Well, I'll take the first crack at that, and I would say the answer is yes.
Okay.
Basically, I think one of the ways that community paramedicine came about was to fill community health gaps.
Mm-hmm.
And by its very nature, community health gaps will be different from community to community,
mm-hmm.
From absolutely nothing in a community to a fairly robust provision of care, but some, you know, glaring things missing. One of those things is the lack of advanced life support emergency response in a rural community. So what we're trying to accomplish is addressing the, you know, what I've called a paramedic paradox, which is the farther you are away from a hospital,
right,
the more you need advanced life support for the big one, and the less likely you are to have that. Well, if you can address that by putting paramedics in communities where they don't exist today and giving them some primary medical care responsibilities, which utilizes their skills so they don't rust out in that setting, you've really addressed what you need to do. But it still returns to the basic question of what are the community health gaps that need to be addressed. And again, by their very nature, they're going to be different from community to community, which makes it difficult to do things like create a curriculum for community paramedicine, although that's being done now with version 3. Are there others who would like to take a crack at that question?
This is Mike from Minnesota, and I certainly understand where you're coming from, and I agree with Kevin's thinking on this. I think part of the curriculum that our CPs are asked to address is going back to their home communities and actually doing an assessment of the community to see what the holes and gaps are within their communities that they can step up and provide support for. So as Kevin has suggested, each community is going to have a little different need,
mm-hmm.
and each community paramedic will be expected to do different things based upon what those holes are in healthcare within their communities.
Anybody else want to take a swat?
This is Julie here in Nebraska, and I agree with needing, you know, looking at the community gaps. We're kind of looking at an urban one in Omaha, which has very specific needs to their underserved and uninsured populations there, and then in the very rural, remote areas of western Nebraska and the Panhandle. And for us, a community may be the entire county,
mm-hmm.
and Cherry County is larger than Connecticut. So, you know, we have some very unique, I think, challenges here, and fitting the curriculum to who you have in that community that can be the community paramedic, and growing that as we're even looking at it as a, like an economic model for job creation, if, you know, to have some type of healthcare in those areas for those folks. So that's kind of how we're looking at it in Nebraska, is whatever that community and who decides what the community is. We're looking at public health to be of an assistance with us there. And, again, not duplicating anything that's out there, but we have big gaps where there is no care. So that's our approach.
And I think you go from that to the service that I'm – this is Kevin again –
that I'm working with now, that I'm chief of, is going to implement community paramedicine in a fairly urban area, well, as urban as Maine gets. By looking at a couple of areas, falls prevention is one of them, and the way we're going to take that is we know that the ambulance services in the greater Portland, Maine area encounter people who have fallen, and they put them back in the bed and don't take them to the hospital. But by virtue of having fallen, that's one of the greatest predictors of another fall. So they are going to voluntarily enroll those folks. All of the ambulance services in the Portland area would do that when they encounter people on emergency calls. Our service will then go out and visit them and do a falls assessment, unless, of course, they are eligible for home health care, in which case we will refer it to our home health agency. So that's one. Another one is our trauma center in Portland runs trauma clinics for patients who have been in the trauma center and then go home. Well, many of these folks are 45 minutes, an hour, 2 hours away from the trauma center, and it makes it's very inconvenient for them to come all the way to Portland for a 15-minute look-see from the trauma surgeon. So we're going to be sending paramedics out with iPads who will go out, assess the patient, set up the iPad for a 5-minute conversation and examination by the trauma surgeon remotely. So those are a couple of other approaches in what is otherwise a very fairly robust healthcare environment.
Right.
Anybody else? Sorry, go ahead.
This is Kevin Mundell from New York City, and obviously I don't have a lot of rural area in my domain, but obviously at the state level there is a lot of interest in the rural side. I want to echo what you said about falls prevention, but I also want to talk about really looking at community paramedicine as a method of just improving the value proposition or improving the efficiency of EMS within the context of the integrated healthcare delivery system. I think from a sort of financial perspective, there's a lot of inefficiencies and almost some incentives to sort of do a lot of the things that aren't necessarily helpful in the system. You know, we transport a lot of patients. So on the input side, I would love for a system in New York to become more adapted to the needs of the patient. And if transport's not something they need, to be able to offer more than that. And so community paramedicine, in the broadest sense, encompasses all the kinds of different elements of what a paramedic should be able to do. And so we're looking on that on the input side. And on the discharge side, or on the post-acute care side, we're really looking at trying to get the most value out of the ride home. You know, we have a lot of patients that get transported by ambulance to the home. There's an opportunity for some patient education and efforts to reduce readmissions and all kinds of things that are big buzzwords in the healthcare reform community. And then the last thing I'd say is I think most people are looking to expand the scope of practice or looking to get additional training, and while it's up to every agency to determine what they want to do, my vision for at least New York City is that there wouldn't be a dramatic or any expansion in training, but really just harnessing the existing value to its fullest potential.
I think that is a fairly common approach, Kevin, across the country. I think we're taking a fairly conservative approach to maintaining the existing scope of practice for a number of reasons, some of which are political. I mean, from a practical point of view, if you start expanding scope of practice, that's going to set a whole lot of red flags waving to other disciplines. So I think that's a very good point.
I think emphasizing that we're changing the role of EMS versus changing the scope of practice is not a bad approach to take.
I actually like that concept better. So thank you all very much. I really appreciate it.
You bet.
This is Mike Mooney again. I have a question again.
Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I wasn't sure you heard me. You know, that said, has anybody done any kind of gap analysis of healthcare services that home healthcare is not touching on that this community paramedicine program could address that's not going to cause conflict but fill gaps? That's one of our biggest challenges, is trying to identify the gaps and how we would go about doing a gap analysis, given all the different agencies that are involved in this.
Kevin, this is Ann Robinson. Do you want me to speak to that one?
Be my guest, Ann.
Okay. When we started our program here in Western Eagle County, Colorado, we worked with, and I was the former nurse manager for their public health, for our public health department, and we utilized our health assessment that all of our public health agencies are required to do. And what that health assessment is, it's a document that, and it was a process that the health department went through of bringing all of those different stakeholders to the table and figuring out where the health priorities and needs and gaps were in the community. So it became our roadmap that the health department already did. And so when I would just advise people to engage their public health departments, because it is a task that they are asked to do all around the nation.
Yes, those are good points, Ann. I know within my agency, my ambulance service, paramedic service, I have a director of business development who is in the process right now of defining the eligible services for home health under Medicare and some of the other payers, so that we have a better idea of where we're stepping on toes and where we're not. Certainly when we figure that one out, we'd be glad to share that.
Kevin, this is Dan Swayze.
Yes, Dan.
I can also share that we've actually developed a process with our hospital or our post-discharge program where the patients are referred to home nursing and their intake center. And if they're eligible for home nursing, they get a home nursing visit. If they're not eligible for home nursing, they refer the patient to our program.
And I think that is an idea that that may scare some, but we're going to take the same approach, we're pretty sure, to coordinate exactly that way to overcome some problems, some issues or potential issues with our home health program. And we owe that one to you, Dan. Other comments, questions?
Kevin, this is Joe from Pennsylvania.
Yeah, Joe.
You know, I see where this could work in urban, rural, EMS. I really think it is the future of EMS. But the biggest stumbling block I've seen in Pennsylvania anyway, and working with Dan over the years, is getting that third party biller to pay for this service. Is there any real true success stories out there? I know there's little pockets here and there, but getting the payers to the table, and this seems to me like it just makes common sense. What has just been a struggle since day one?
Well, I agree, and I think you will. You'll have the Minnesota story on the Medicare side, or Medicaid side, I'm sorry. And we have, you know, public health nursing supporting community paramedicine in Eagle County, Western Eagle County. So there are pockets where reimbursement models are being tried. But I think one of the things that we need to remember is that we are right on the cutting edge at this point, that a lot of these programs and services are just starting. And it's going to take us some time to establish an evidence-based track record to justify investment from third parties. Now, having said that, there are two things I'd like to emphasize. One is that there should be no community paramedic program or community paramedicine project started that does not have prospective research model in it or data collection model, because that's the only way we're going to get the evidence. Now, the nice thing is that those, we don't have a ton of evidence out there. There is data starting to take shape. I know Dan has got some data in Pittsburgh. We have some nice data emerging from Nova Scotia and some other places. There's data on frequent flyer management in some locales. And one of the things to look at, despite the lack of that data, the
Medicaid and Medicare, the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Innovation grant, the fact that it has specifically cited community paramedicine as something it wants to explore is very, very exciting. So we need to be our own best friends in this and make sure that all the programs that we establish have the kinds of research components to establish on our base. Other comments?
Just Buckley in Minnesota, I'd step back to what the gentleman said about third-party payer. Our health plans actually came to us and supported our legislation. We work with about six or seven different payers, and I think that you're looking for partners before you go with legislation. You have to get to your state hospital associations. I happen to work for a large hospital, and quite a bit of our payments for Medicaid and Medicare under managed care are based off total cost of care. So they're very open to negotiating. Our state health plans have even offered to design the fee schedule and the billing process after our bill passed a few weeks ago over how we would do it for fee-for-service Medicaid, how we do it for managed care, and how we could do it as part of Medicare as our managed care payments to hospitals. So I think that's the groups you have to work with as you put this together. And I think all the success of this program the next few years are going to be based how any of us, private, not-for-profit, whatever, can get in and work at the hospital level like some of you just talked about you're doing. And that'll take care of our home health problems and our other discharge issues.
I think that's a very good point. As I think Dan Swayze will point out, though, you do need to get to those tables with your with a community paramedicine solution, because there will be plenty of other folks within a health system who have different takes on how those solutions ought to be crafted to best promote their particular interests of their agency. Other comments on the reimbursement theme? Are there other comments or questions on any theme? I would like to get close up with maybe a little bit of an update from Ann Robinson on curriculum development, but anything else that people want to talk about that have raised issues or questions from what we've already gone over? Okay. Well, we have a short bit of time left to us. Ann, what can you tell us about the curriculum? How are we doing?
We have started our pilot class through Colorado Mountain College, and it's a class that we have 107 students from 27 agencies and from 14 states around the nation. And the class is being taught in an online fashion through Blackboard, and it's been challenging to coordinate all of these students and get all of this information, this brand new information, out to everybody. But I think we're into, in Module 3, people are now really getting the gist, and all of those little quirks are getting all worked out. So it's exciting to see how so many people engaged in this class. The curriculum itself has, the 3.0 curriculum has, is just been completed, and it's under the review process from our review team. And after that, then it will be able and to be disseminated to any accredited college or university. Anyone that has requested the curriculum and has the older version will also receive this updated version when it's available. We're excited with what the product looks like, and we know that there will be a lot of colleges that we're hoping to bring those colleges together to teach this next class that's coming up here. Hopefully in the fall we can coordinate more regional sites to host the next class, to cut down the size and the complexity of having so many students. Anything else that I can answer, or any questions that people have?
This is Mike and Mike Wilcox in Minnesota. Real happy to say we're utilizing that module for that third phase of the curriculum in the work we're doing here in our state. And I've had the opportunity to be part of the review team that's reviewing the curriculum, and very pleased with what we're being presented with. What I find very useful in the curriculum, there appears to be some opportunities to build into the teaching, and especially the clinical teaching, areas of work depending upon what the needs are of the community. So there's some flexibility. I think this was brought up before. How can you train a CP who's working in a rural community to do what they're expected to do if your focus primarily is on what's going on in a metro? Well, it gives these students an opportunity through the flexibility of the curriculum to get additional training in the areas where they need to be trained to do the work they have to do in their communities.
This is Bill Rainovich, if I may. Just thanking Dr. Wilcox for stepping in there and saying that, and just say I'm proud and pleased to be on that team with Dr. Wilcox, and we've got a good group of people working on that third version.
Any questions about the curriculum or the classes that are going on now? Or going on in the fall? Or just about anything you might want to talk about?
Yeah, this is Mike Rehart from Pennsylvania. This kind of expands on Joe Schmieder's question, and that is, as we roll out in Pennsylvania a community health program, what would be your recommendation as to our focus for people that would have an investment in community medicine? Would it be major hospital systems, third-party payers? Where would you put your biggest focus, like on a 1-2-3 scale?
Anybody want to take a crack at that?
This is Dan Smith again. I can take a stab. Based on our experience, I'd say the priority from a timeline standpoint is to approach health plans early, only because they tend to have such a long adoption cycle for these types of programs. When we go to them with a new idea for a program that they could implement, we found that it takes about 18 months on average before we start to see patient referrals into it. Hospitals tend to be a little bit faster in terms of turnaround and being able to implement and send patients to you, and they're definitely number two on my list, given the changes in the healthcare reimbursement that are coming up. A lot of them are very interested in looking at programs that reduce readmission rates and address chronic diseases and the like. And then the other group I would forget about are your community members, either the employers in your area or even out-of-pocket programs that you could develop that people might be willing to pay for additional services, either for new babies or elderly parents that they can't see. So there's lots of opportunities out there, but I think the health plans and the hospitals are definitely number one, number two on the hit list.
I would agree with that. Other comments? I think, too, our comments earlier about home health agencies and similar programs that are going to be rubbing shoulders with you in terms of the scope of the program that you want are ones that you need to coordinate with early on, unless you intend to compete with them head-to-head, which I would not advise. Coordination is a good thing.
Thank you.
Are there other comments or questions?
Well, this is Mike Lee again from New.
Yeah,
I'm sorry. I always come late coming into the show. Sorry about that, Kevin.
Hey, no, just okay. A question.
A question about the curriculums, the educational curriculums. Has anybody looked at? And I apologize if this has already been covered, but at an e-learning alternative to a classroom program for the community paramedicine didactic.
I can answer that question. That's what we're doing. That is exactly what we're doing right now. We're using the Blackboard platform, but that could be adapted to any other e-learning system that any other college or university would have. So that's kind of part of the challenging part, though, is having one instructor working with so many students in that type of environment. But we're figuring that out, and it is improving as we are going through the process and as we get through each module of the curriculum.
Great. I appreciate that information, and I apologize for not knowing it ahead of time.
No problem.
That's what we're here for. Okay, we're
coming down to the end here, we'll take a last thread of topic if somebody wants to toss one out. Okay, well, hearing none, I want to thank everybody who participated today. I think this is a wonderful updating session, and I know I learned a lot. Our next Community Paramedicine Insights Forum will be on the third Monday of May, and we look forward to seeing you at 3 o'clock Eastern Time. And, Chris, you can turn off our recording. Thank you very much.
Thanks, everybody. We'll see you.
Thank you. Please stand by.